In 1961, Michael Rockefeller, the 23-year-old son of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller, vanished in the Arafura Sea off a remote coast of New Guinea while he was collecting pieces for the Museum of Primitive Art. After clinging to a capsized catamaran for many hours in crocodile and shark-infested waters, Michael assured his expedition partner, "I think I can make it," and then swam for shore. He was never to be seen again, and despite exhaustive searches, no trace of his body was ever found. Carl Hoffman has revisited this 50-year-old cold case, retracing Rockefeller's route and looking for answers, which he details in Savage Harvest, A Tale of Cannibals, Colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's Tragic Quest for Primitive Art. It's published by William Morrow. We're very pleased to welcome him to our show today.
Thanks so much.
There's a bit of irony in the fact that we now have this missing airplane in an area not all that far from what happened here.
Yeah, absolutely, and it goes to the heart of the you know, that when things vanish, it's incredibly compelling, and it's hard to avert your gaze from it.
Well, you're a travel writer and a novelist. Did that lead you into investigating this story?
Well, I first heard about the story 30 years ago when I was the same age as Michael, you know, 23 years old, just out of college and starting to travel around the world, and heard the tale, and I identified with him. It resonated with me.
Would you say that this is as much of a cultural ethnography as it is about solving the mystery of what happened to Michael Rockefeller?
Yes. I mean, the things in a way that I'm most proud of in the book are the sense of hopefully capturing a really remote and foreign people and trying to help understand them.
How did you go about retracing the footsteps of someone who disappeared over a half century ago?
Well, the book is built on really two pillars. One is archival research, and I think that what I noticed when I started looking back at the story was that there had been rumors that he had made it to shore and he'd been killed for years and years and years, for decades, but all of those rumors always had an incredible lack of specificity. I mean, there were always these reports that a Dutch policeman had committed an atrocity, but who was the Dutch policeman? When did it happen? And I looked at that and said, there must be records.
That Dutch policeman's atrocity occurred before Michael Rockefeller wound up disappearing. Now, what was he doing in the water in the first place?
Michael Rockefeller was collecting primitive art. His father, Nelson, was governor of New York, and he had opened the Museum of Primitive Art in 1957, and it was the first museum dedicated to primitive art, and Michael was a member of the Board of Trustees at the age of 19.
But then the boat capsized?
They got into rough water at the mouth of river, big tides and currents. The boat went upside down, and they floated for 24 hours, and Michael swam away.
Was he looking for the Azmat tribe?
He had already been traveling among them. This was actually his second trip to Azmat, and he had spent about a month, 5 weeks in the spring, early summer of 61, and then he came back in the fall, and he'd already been on this whole sort of northern route and 13 villages over about 3 weeks, and now he was going to a much remoter southern part that had less contact from the outside world.
And he was collecting art. Did he have any insight into the significance of that art for the people who made it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think Michael was a pretty smart guy, and he was earnest, and he was trying to understand deeply Azmat culture, which was built on very complex spirit world and ideas of reciprocal violence, of battling. There's all this intertribal warfare, and their carvings all embodied spirits that were sort of promises to revenge their deaths.
So that made it a bit more dangerous. But didn't his father say that he was interested in the aesthetics of a piece, not the reasons that it was made?
Yeah, which is pretty interesting and is, I think you can look at a piece of Azmat art and you can appreciate its aesthetics, as Nelson surely did. But, you know, tribal art like that is all, you can't disassociate it from its sacred purpose. And, you know, for the Azmat, every shield and every totem pole had profound sacred significance. And so we come at that those objects in a, from a very different place than the Azmat.
You note that in Michael's correspondence to his family and friends, he dismissed the threat of cannibalism in the region. Could he have been downplaying the threat to keep people from worrying, or do you think that he just thought that he was perfectly safe, especially as a white man, because the Dutch claimed that if there was cannibalism, it was usually intertribal and they weren't interested in white people?
Well, I think the Dutch at the time had a vested interest in – the Dutch were trying to retain Papua, and the foreign minister was making a presentation to the United Nations General Assembly the very week he disappeared, and the Dutch
it's now part of Indonesia.
Correct.
And there's also Australian in New Guinea, Papua, or Papua New Guinea.
Correct. It's an island divided into two countries. The eastern half is Papua New Guinea, and the western half is Indonesian Papua. But, you know, the Dutch maintain that the Azmat had been pacified and that there was no more headhunting. And, the you know, Michael's letters are, and journal entries are really kind of fascinating because on the one hand he's saying – they've stopped the headhunting, and but he was looking for pure, you know, the purest art that he could find, and the pure art was you know, intimately tied to headhunting and all of the ceremonies related to it.
And not only did the Dutch claim that he had drowned, but the Rockefeller family also claimed that he drowned.
Well, you know, after he disappeared, the Dutch undertook this enormous two-week search, and helicopters flown in from Australia, and ships and planes, and Nelson and Michael's twin sister Mary jumped on a plane and flew to New Guinea, and they spent, you know, several weeks. But at the end, they found nothing, and I think the Rockefellers, everybody believed that he had disappeared at sea. And
my guess is Carl Hoffman, whose latest book is Savage Harvest, A Tale of Cannibals, Colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's Tragic Quest for Primitive Art. The subtitle kind of spills the beans. You write that a 10-foot spear was plunged into his chest while he was still in the water, and then he was gutted. And I'm not going to go through any of the details because some people are eating lunch right now, but he wound up being divvied up and eaten. And then other religious rituals were involved his body. How do you know that?
Well, the book is really a long accretion of layers, you know, detail after detail after detail that adds up. You know, there's a huge amount of archival material. I found hundreds of pages of records and cables and letters, missionaries who did quite extensive investigations and discovered that he had been killed and consumed. And then the details of how that killing would have taken place are, you know, these were not cannibalism was a byproduct of headhunting, which itself was a sacred ritual, and all of these practices were fairly clearly articulated in anthropological journals. And if they had done it, that's how they would have done it.
You kill the person, and then when you eat them, their spirit comes into your body. And then how does that affect the art that they make?
Yeah, I become you. I kill you, and I eat you, and I become you. I even take your name, and your family even treats me as you.
That gives you more power?
And gives you more power, and it also tends to balance the world. And that was all related to the art, because the poles, and which were the most significant pieces of art. These are 23 foot totem poles, ornately carved, and those were obligations to the pole would carry a name, for instance, your name, and it would be my sort of sacred obligation to revenge your, to reciprocate your death.
So the unfinished poles represented the people who had been killed by the Dutch policemen. Revenge was necessary because this is a reciprocal culture.
Correct. Absolutely.
Have the Azmats changed since 1961?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, they're Catholics now. They've been, you know, the missionaries proselytizing since the mid-1950s. And, you know, they wear tattered – they're not naked anymore. They wear tattered T-shirts and holy short gym shorts. You know, and they cross themselves before they eat. And but at the same time, they're – you know, they take communion and have three – wives, multiple wives, and they still live in an incredibly rich spirit world. I mean, there's spirits in everything still.
But I assume you felt less threatened than Michael Rockefeller might have.
I was never worried. I spent 4 months there, two-month journeys. I was never worried of physical violence against myself.
How do you communicate with them? As I understand it, there are hundreds of different languages spoken in New Guinea by hundreds of different tribes, all living isolated from each other.
Yeah, there are about 40,000 Asmat on the southwest coast, and they speak some different dialects of Asmat, but it has been an part of Indonesia since 1962. So everybody speaks Indonesian, and I, for my second trip there, I felt like I needed to go much, much deeper, and I learned to speak Bahasa Indonesian, and so I could go there and live with them with no filters, no translators, no guides.
Well, could you just ask members of the tribe, did you kill and eat Michael Rockefeller?
You can ask that if you want, but you don't really get very far. You know, it's kind of like a black hole. When you're in the very specific, this one village, the village of Ochinep, which was the village named in the original reports as having killed Michael, you know, if you go into Ochinep and you ask the sons of the men who are named as having killed him, did you, you know, tell us the story of Michael Rockefeller, they'll say either we don't know this story, or they'll say we know this story, but we don't know anything about it. If you ask other questions, you can, if you look around the edges, you can see all of these things. The motive becomes very, very strong. You ask about the village history and who these men were who were killed by the Dutch patrol officer Max Lepre, and how the men who were present at his killing in the original reports were related to those men.
None of the people who participated are still alive? You said you spoke to their sons.
Their sons are all still there. There are people tend to not live very long in Asmat, and they look very old even when they're not that old. There are definitely people in their 60s and 70s who would have been alive. I could not find anyone who admitted to being present at his murder. The man I lived with was certainly alive at the time.
Well, you showed the Asmat photographs that Michael had taken of them. What was their reaction?
That was an unbelievably moving experience. Michael took a lot of beautiful photos, and the Asmat are in a very pure, sort of uncontacted state. And when I showed those photos, you know, the Asmat would come just like fill up the room, fill up the house. There'd be dozens of people pressing in, and they would trace the photos, and they had never seen photos of their relatives before, and they could identify everybody in the picture and what sort of clan they belonged to. It was really extraordinary.
After you came back, did you tell the Rockefellers what you'd found?
I have. I've been in correspondence with his twin sister.
And what was her reaction?
She hasn't spoken to me since she's read the book. You know, I think the Rockefeller family feels that it's a private matter and they'd rather not talk about it, and it saddens them.
On the other hand, if Michael hadn't been a Rockefeller, do you think the truth would have been revealed earlier?
Well, it never would have happened if he hadn't been a Rockefeller. I mean, a 23-year-old American kid wouldn't have been wandering through that part of the world at that time, you know, spending a lot of money, buying a lot of objects fast in a place that had barely had any contact.
Perhaps the Rockefellers don't like the fact that he comes across as a really smart but entitled person.
Well, as I said to Mary, I mean, I think the sins he committed were the sins of youth.
Hmm. Well, we're still debating over whether we should take these religious artifacts. We may see them as works of art, but whether we should take things that have another kind of significance to any group and put them in museums.
Well, absolutely, and not just that, but to when you're purchasing them, as Michael did, from a people who don't really understand the value of both their own objects and the things, you know, he was trading fish hooks and nylon fishing line for objects that even in 1962 were valued at, you know, $250,000.
Carl Hoffman will be reading and speaking at CUNY's Macaulay Honors College on 67th Street tonight at 7 p.m. For more information about that, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Do you think this resolves it once and for all?
I think it does.
Carl Hoffman's book is called Savage Harvest, A Tale of Cannibals, Colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's Tragic Quest for Primitive Art. It's published by William Morrow. Thank you so much for being on our show
today. Thank you.